This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
We're really getting into now the streaming's arms race.
Dish is looking at that and saying we can really build a nice niche for ourselves.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
The dollar is the dominant content in the planet.
I think the acquisition is a natural progression of what Microsoft can do with this technology going forward.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we're going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts are covering worldwide.
Today, we're going to take a look at the sales lift from General Dynamics' Gulfstream lineup.
Plus, Procter & Gamble was reaping the benefits from the pandemic recovery and work-from-home trends.
But first, we want to welcome back a guest we haven't spoken to in a long time, Eric Balchunas, Bloomberg Intelligence ETF analyst. Eric, how have you been?
I'm back.
He's back.
And it's nice to be back. I miss you guys.
We miss you too. So let's talk about Bitcoin meets mutual funds meets ETFs. Where are we?
Here's the state of the race. The first step of approval is probably going to happen in the next week or two. And the first step meaning they're going to probably approve Bitcoin futures ETFs. So this wouldn't be like a real spot Bitcoin tracker like GLD is to gold. And the reason for that is because Gary Gensler of the SEC just doesn't really feel comfortable with the 1933 Act, which those are filed under. They have less investor protections than the 40 Act. But Bitcoin isn't a security, and the 40 Act, you can only file a fund that holds securities. Thus, the only way to appease Gensler's desire to have a 40 Act fund is to have Bitcoin futures. The downside to that is that futures, as you know, Alex, from covering commodities, they expire. So you have to roll to the next month, and that rolling can be costly. And so we're anticipating maybe 10 to 15% a year of roll costs. Now, you would pay that if you did it on your own. It's not like, you know, an extra hidden nefarious fee, but that's just what happens when you hold futures. That's, I think that Bitcoin's can be so potent in returns. I think people will still look to use it and buy it. It might become a trading tool for some. But it won't be nearly the big hit that a physically backed Bitcoin ETF will be. So, again, we say a 75% chance that they will start rolling out over the next couple weeks. I leave a 25% chance because the SEC has pulled the football away, Lucy style, many times. But in this case, because Gensler has signaled so much that he is okay with the 40 Act, we're pretty confident. But I am factoring in that this is an unusual situation and a seven-year story.
What is the demand out there for these ETF Bitcoins? It seems to me like it would be phenomenal. And this is something that the U.S. needs to get really on board with.
Yeah, but there will be demand. But like, for example, like up in Canada, they have a Bitcoin futures ETF and they have physical. And the Bitcoin futures one has less than 1% of the assets of the physically backed ones. Now, here, there is no physically backed. So if the Bitcoin futures is the only game in town for, say, a year, right? I would see a couple billion probably going into it. That's our guess, which is pretty good. I mean, that's billions of dollars. But relative to, say, the size of Bitcoin, that's less than 1% of the market cap. It's also less than 1% of annual ETF flows every year. So maybe it'll be higher, maybe lower. I've got some side bets going with other analysts who some feel it will be even less than $4 billion. I think I'm underestimating, if anything. But the thing is, advisors in particular, who these ETFs are namely for, they don't really like derivatives. And so they may hold out and continue to hold out for the real deal or go to Coinbase or something and just buy it directly. Now there's services that help advisors just buy Bitcoin and crypto directly. So those other ways that, you know, it's become easier to buy crypto are also a factor in our sort of underestimating of that $4 billion. That said, the crypto community is clearly excited, but they get excited for everything. So they're pumped up. They think this is going to be a big catalyst event, but
sure,
it's possible it's a sell the news kind of event, to be honest.
What about roll costs?
Yeah, I mean, again, we're saying 10 to 20% a year is probably a safe estimate. As more money comes into the market.
Is that a lot?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's healthy. Okay. I mean, like, there's other commodities, the roll cost is very minimal, like gold.
Mm-hmm.
And there's some that are crazy, like VIX. VIX could be 40% a year.
Wow.
Oil has sometimes been 40. So I'd put this in the medium category, 10 to 20%. But it's possible the roll costs are worse when people are optimistic about Bitcoin, because then obviously the curve would slope up. But the idea here that you would be buying more expensive futures out would mean people are bullish on Bitcoin, which means your fund is up. So perhaps the roll cost won't be as annoying when you're up a lot anyway, versus when you're down and then you're hit with roll costs, which can sometimes happen in oil.
Talk to us about a Bitcoin mutual fund. I thought something was launched recently. Did that get much traction?
No. And this is also why we are kind of a little, pessimistic about the possibility, the assets for these. The Bitcoin Futures Mutual Fund launched 2.5 months ago from ProFunds, and it only has $15 million. I mean, that is really low. Now, I don't know. The mutual fund wrapper is just out of vogue. People don't want it, things in mutual funds anymore. So we're trying to suss out like whether it's the mutual fund or the futures. We think it's a little of both, but probably more the mutual fund. But that was a bad sign. That said, the fact that Gensler approved a futures mutual fund, because it's under the 40 Act, gave us the confidence we had to make our 75% prediction, because honestly, an ETF and a mutual fund are virtually the same thing. One just trades on an exchange. Thus, the fact that he approved that is why we think he will have no problem, or they will have no problem approving the same thing in an ETF wrapper. But yeah, that was a bad sign.
Eric, thanks a lot. It was really good to hear your voice. Eric Balchunas, Bloomberg Intelligence ETF analyst.
Coming up on the program, rising costs creep into supermarket prices. More coming up.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing you in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
All right, let's talk about inflation. We are seeing it all over the place in this economy, particularly in agricultural products. So the question is, to what extent are we seeing it in the supermarket aisles? Let's bring in Charles Allen, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Retail Analyst. So, Charles, what are we seeing from some of the big supermarket chains? How well are they passing along some of the price increases that the Procter and Gambles of the world are charging?
Yeah, good afternoon, Paul. I mean, I think we're just sort of seeing this coming in slow motion at the moment. That's the sort of the best way to describe it. We can see the producer prices, to which you alluded, going up quite a lot, and some of them up more than 30%, things like oils. And then you can see it in the producer price. The producer price input prices are there. And then it's beginning to come through in their output prices. But at least in Europe, I mean, actual consumer price inflation in food remains quite low and, sort of low single digits. But I think we all know that it's going to pick up, and that these price increases we've seen in the system are going to come through, and we're going to start seeing it picking up towards mid-single digit.
Is this a different... What regime were we in before? Like, how price competitive were supermarkets before all of this?
Well, I mean, I think, at least in Europe, and I think in the US as well, actually, we've had for at least 10 years the continuing rise of the limited assortment discounters, and they've really put pressure for everyone to keep prices down. So I think, supermarkets have really worked to regain their price competitive position against lower priced rivals, and so big companies like Carrefour in France or Tesco in the UK have worked to bring their prices down. And I mean, it's one reason why there's little being said about it, because having reestablished your reputation for low prices, you don't want to say out loud, we're going to put them up.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, my knowledge of the supermarket business is just super low margins for the retailers, and I guess they make it up on volume, as they say here. So I'm surprised the supermarkets haven't taken this opportunity to try to push through some more price increases, because, boy, we see it every other part of the economy.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm sure they will when the time comes, because if the price of oil has gone up, then everyone has to pass it on. But you don't want to be the first one doing it, because customers will notice, if suddenly your you know, 5% more expensive than someone else, then people will notice. And because you've got this sort of overwhelming presence of Aldi, Lidl, and in some countries Netto, you know, to keep prices down, you just, the people are just waiting for it to be a necessity to happen. And then, as I say, I'm sure we will see prices going up, but no supermarket wants to be the one that's saying, we're definitely going to put prices up, and they don't want to be visible in that.
They don't want to be the first mover, basically. Which company is best poised to either manage this margin squeeze or have more pricing power?
You know, I mean, the pricing power is pretty limited because of the, you know, continuing competition. I think, you know, where we'll see people doing better is if your overall volume increase is the, you know, the actual number of packets and everything you're putting through your business is going up, as it probably is at Tesco at the moment. In the US, it's going up at quite a few retailers, as it might be going up at Carrefour in France. Then you're in a better position with your suppliers. Your suppliers will like you more because of that, and therefore you can manage the price increases better.
Charles, I know a couple of weeks ago the story was there weren't enough truck drivers in the UK to get the fuel from the ports to where it needs to go. Is that also an issue for consumer products getting to supermarkets?
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously the UK is worse affected, but I mean, right through the supply chain of non-food, you know, there's a shortage of containers, or the containers are in the wrong place. So goods, you know, are coming through more slowly than they should be. And obviously, as we're approaching the peak Christmas season, people need the items to be in store quite quickly. So, yeah, it is a problem in the UK. Anecdotally, if you walk into a supermarket, there are many, many more blank spaces than you'd normally expect.
Crazy. Yeah. Just crazy. Okay, talking about consolidation, and I feel like private equity also wants to get into this space.
Yeah, I mean, it is certainly in the UK. I mean, I think the essentially the supermarket story in most countries in Western Europe is now, you know, revenue growth is going to be pretty low for a few years. You've had a really big bump up because of COVID, and it's a question of really, can we maintain that higher level of revenue? And that's still a bit up in the air. So, you know, we're looking at single-digit revenue growth for a lot of these companies. But on the other hand, they're quite cash generative. They're, you know, they're not investing as much as they used to, and they throw off cash. So public markets haven't particularly appreciated that story. They want revenue growth and things like that. But if you're private equity, maybe you're not quite so fussed about the revenue growth, but you like the amount of cash that's coming off.
Here in the States, Charles, as you well know, some of the big box retailers are actually huge in the grocery business. I'm thinking Walmart here. Talk to us, how is it in the UK and Europe?
Well, I think that the very big boxes have are not necessarily the ones that have been growing fastest. And, I mean, realistically, and I think this to a degree applies to Walmart, although they've fought back more, is, you know, the big box hypermarket or supercenter or whatever you want to call it was the big victim of the internet. Is, you know, the idea was you had the food to attract people into the store, and then you had a big selection of low-priced general merchandise. But the internet has an even bigger selection of often even lower priced general merchandise. So the rationale of that business model has sort of faded. But in the food part, yeah, bigger boxes are probably slightly better now because there's a bit more space. I mean, even nowadays, people don't necessarily want to be all huddled up together, sort of looking through the fruit and things like that.
All right, Charles, thank you so much. We appreciate that. Charles Allen, Bloomberg Intelligence senior retail analyst based in London.
All right, coming up on the program, it's the outlook for Procter & Gamble amid commodity and freight headwinds.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It's 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
Hey, This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
So we just hit on food companies, supermarkets, and inflation. So let's go to the everyday stuff like your toothbrush, your toothpaste, your dental floss, Procter & Gamble, and what they have to do when it comes to their margins and the input pressures they're seeing. We're welcomed now by Deborah Aiken, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Luxury Goods and Home Care Analyst. We also want to talk luxury, but first, let's go to P&G. How are they doing with all these supply chain rising cost issues?
I think what they're doing is they're managing very well, and how they're doing that is that they've become, despite being the huge company that they are globally, they certainly are not the size that they were 5 years ago. When we think about them now, they're five different divisions and 10 categories, global categories overall. So they're really honed in. And then if we think about them over the last 10 years, they've had two sets of five-year, $10 billion cost savings programs. And that all works in their favor. And even now, they're looking at reducing things like media spend and being so focused on it hugely in the next few years. So there are still savings to be had and organic growth to build in. So very, very well.
Talk to us about the inflation, because that's kind of the topic du jour recently. What's the company saying about their costs and the ability of P&G to pass along those costs throughout the line?
Absolutely. So we saw at the June report, so they're due to report on the 19th of October. We saw in the June report when they came through that they were seeing some teens increase in some of their input costs between even April and July when they last really talked openly to the market about those numbers. And how are they dealing with that? Some costs are more stable than others, and given the breadth and the depth of their portfolio and the fact that they're number one or number two brands and really more innovative than they ever were, some of that is passed on in mix, some of it is ability to raise pricing, and some of it is through cost savings. So it will pressure margin for all of these companies, but when you compare against the biggest and the best brands in class, then we would say that the pressure that they receive is less than elsewhere. Just to give you a little a number that's come through for this week, and more recently, IRI data released at the 3rd of October, in that data for P&G in the US, we can see they're really managing inflationary pressures with some prices raised 3 to 4% on the month versus a year ago. So they're passing that through, and that diverse portfolio is allowing that to happen.
Do they have any more levers to pull, though? You mentioned that they were going through all these cost-saving programs. If things get tighter, do they have more levers?
Absolutely. So they've given, when we think about them last year, they returned $19 billion to shareholders in the form of $8 billion dividend, $11 billion share repurchase. And what they've estimated for this year is, again, maintenance of dividend at $8 billion, but $7 to $9 billion on the return via share buyback. So that does give them some leeway anyway when they're ordinarily expecting COGS to be about $2 billion higher. And on top of that, they've done things like raise media budget, but then they're saying they're looking at the budget overall to come through with annual savings and efficiencies to really offset higher inflationary pressures. So, for example, $2 billion of media efficiency savings to come through again, as they did in the last 5 years, and take that as an opportunity for the next few years.
All right, Deb, let's kind of switch our focus a little bit and talk luxury, since we've got you on the line. Talk to us just about how the luxury category performed from a sales perspective throughout the pandemic, and now that we are, presumably on a global scale to varying degrees, coming out on the other side of this pandemic.
So if we look at what happened in 2020, on average, we saw a 17% revenue decline versus 2019, and we saw a 38% EPS decline in 2020 versus 2019. As we headed through 2021, store reopenings, more people into shopping malls, a lot more transition online, and great flexibility from so many companies on individualbrands.com as well as third-party marketplaces, that helped full recoveries for some companies by Q1, other companies by Q2 of this year. We had peak valuation by the end of June, beginning of July, and we then started to hear the rumors coming through, and it affecting different categories outside of luxury on common prosperity out of Beijing. Mm. And what that did for the sector overall was to see the average share price momentum by July of over 60% down to 30%. So it gave back, or there was profit taken on half of that. What we started to see now is that we're picking up and we start to see earnings coming through.
Great analysis, Deborah. Thank you so much. Deborah Aiken, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Luxury Goods and Home Care Analyst.
All right, coming up on the program, long-range jets lift General Dynamics aerospace sales, and regional banks could see a revenue boon from a steeper yield curve.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing you in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
One part of this reflation narrative that we've been seeing is this steeper yield curve. Now, it's not crazy steep, but it is getting steeper. And one beneficiary of that is most definitely going to be the regional banks, where you wind up borrowing money for the lower rate, and then you lend it out for the higher rate in the back end of the curve. Want to get more here from Herman Chan, a Bloomberg Intelligence Senior U.S. Regional Banks Analyst. All right, Herman, just tell me how good it could be for the regional banks.
Yeah, sure. So just a quick step back. Definitely a steeper yield curve portends a better share price for the regionals, as the steeper yield curve in a higher 10-year treasury is reflected in earnings multiples for banks and regionals in particular that are more susceptible to rate swings. What's helpful for the banks is that while typically earnings will improve by Fed rate cuts, but this time around, because the banks have much more liquidity on their balance sheets because of all this deposit inflows from the Fed's QE and stimulus from the government that continues to help the consumers, banks are flush with liquidity and can invest that liquidity in the form of securities. So we've written in our research about a potential 5 to 7% growth in pre-tax, pre-provision net revenue for a few of our banks that are more liquid on their balance sheet. Banks like Signature and M&T have better upside, we believe, when they could potentially invest their excess liquidity into the securities market.
Talk to us about loan demand out there. You mentioned all the liquidity that's in the marketplace. Does anybody need a loan these days?
It's tough because you have some competing factors, right? You have, for the regionals, it's much more commercial oriented. So you have the Paycheck Protection Program. Those loans are being forgiven and are coming off the balance sheet. And then you've got a weak demand from commercial borrowers. That is due to a couple factors: difficulty in hiring and the supply chain issues that everybody continues to grapple with. So you have muted loan demand. You have the PPP forgiveness. And it's tough for the banks to really deliver loan growth with those competing factors. And you've got an open capital markets where the larger corporate borrowers can just go to the capital markets and pay off their loans. So it's tough for the regional banks to grow. You've seen some pockets of growth from areas like residential mortgage and auto lending for the consumers, but overall it's been tough sledding.
Do you think that turns at some point? Like, we're going to get to a quarter where we start to see some nice loan expansion, or is this going to be the hard slog?
It's going to be a tough slog. Mm. You've heard a bunch of the companies that I cover talking about 2022 being a bit more difficult given the supply chain issues, especially with the banks that lend to auto dealers and the chip shortage. That's going to take a while to deal through and muddle through. So it's going to be tough sledding, at least over into the new year in our view. But the hope is that we get through those issues, and then the banks could potentially grow in the back half of next year.
Your title is Regional Bank Analyst. Are there certain regions of the country today that are performing better than others? Are you making any kind of call there?
Yeah, I guess I would say that there still strong growth in areas like in Silicon Valley, where we cover a couple banks, SVB, Silicon Valley Bank, and also Signature Bank, that lends to the venture capital and private equity firms. That business continues to do really well. And you've seen a lot of dry powder put into work, and you've seen a lot of M&A activities with technology companies and life sciences companies. So all of those factors continues to help deliver loan growth for a couple of these banks that we cover that are more levered to what's going on the West Coast.
Which areas and which banks are the worst set up for this?
Yeah, I think the banks that have a bit more commercial real estate exposure, because the pandemic, while we're closer to the other side, there's still some lingering issues, especially with commercial real estate from borrowers in office or hotels. The banks that have more exposure to New York City CRE, like an M&T, probably has a longer recovery period. And then banks that lend to auto dealers that I mentioned before. So those are banks like Comerica, banks like Huntington, and also M&T that have a bit more exposure to the weakness in the supply chain with respect to auto.
All right, Herman, thanks a lot. Really appreciate it. Herman Chan joining us, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior U.S. Regional Banks Analyst.
All right, Alex, I live near a private airport in New Jersey, and I can tell you the private jet business is hopping. I mean, these things are buzzing over day and night. Let's get a sense of what it means for one of the big players, General Dynamics. They got the Gulfstream. That's what I'm talking about. Doug Rothick, our Bloomberg Intelligence Aerospace Analyst. So, again, if I were going to be in the market, Doug, I think I might be looking at some Gulfstreams. Talk to us about the importance of Gulfstream to this General Dynamics story.
Sure. Thanks for having me on. You mentioned how you've seen an uptick in traffic, and that's absolutely the case. If we look at FAA BizJet traffic, I mean, it returned to 2019 levels already by spring of 2021. So the group collectively is already in a growth mode, and the broader demand backdrop is really pretty positive. And if you contrast that with the commercial passenger traffic, if we look at TSA numbers, they're still down 20-25% from 2019. So obviously for Gulfstream and their peers, again, the demand has really been quite impressive, the snapback there. And so they introduced two new aircraft last week, the G400 and G800, and we think this puts them on a pretty good path to get to about $10 billion of revenue in the aerospace division by 2023. And that's, about 20% of their revenue right now, but could grow pretty substantially over the coming years, and offers a pretty good offset to some potential moderation in the defense business.
So before we get to defense, so weirdly, business travel is totally there. It's just in the private jet space. Yeah. It's just not on the commercial airlines, but it's back. And I wonder how much more that could actually grow and then help the bottom line.
Yeah, I think, one key driver of BizJet demand is companies rolling out new models. And so we've seen a pretty consistent cadence over the past number of years with General Dynamics every 2 years or so rolling out new products. And so ultimately that stokes, obviously it stokes competition as well as demand. We've seen their backlog grow pretty impressively in the first half of the year, a 1.5 book-to-bill. Their competitors are obviously ramping up new programs as well. So the competitive landscape is getting obviously more challenging over the coming years. But obviously everybody's fighting for that large cabin market share where you can get aircraft that cost north of $70 million.
All right. So if I do go out and shop for my G7 or G8, that's the kind of money I'm talking about. Who am I competing against for these planes? Who's buying these things?
This is obviously ultra high net worth individuals that need to be somewhere very fast. I mean, these ultra long range aircraft can fly halfway around the world without refueling, and so we've seen a pretty impressive demand shift, if you will, from commercial aviation, where obviously everything going on with the pandemic and restrictions around the world has shifted really to the business aviation side. And again, U.S. domestic FAA BizJet traffic is already in a growth mode, and I think that'll continue for at least a number of years now. I mean, we're still at least a few years away from returning to 2019 levels on a commercial commercial passenger level, and we've already exceeded that on BizJet basis. So,
here's a question for you. As we sort of shift to greener things, planes, et cetera, what does General Dynamics do with that? Like, do they have to make new planes or engines? Like, do they not have to worry about it because rich people are going to go buy trees? Like, how does this happen?
So I wouldn't say they wouldn't have to worry about it. The sector collectively is researching and investing in new fuels, sustainable fuels for commercial air travel, broadly speaking. And obviously, on a very small scale, there's investments and research being done on, electric type of short travel vehicles. I still think we're very long ways away from being that a significant part of the market. So I think if you're on this, 5-year, maybe 10-year horizon, I mean, General Dynamics is basically laying their product portfolio for at least a decade here with the recent unveiling of these aircraft.
Who does Gulfstream compete against? What's kind of the market breakdown here of the players?
Yeah, so if you go back about 10 years ago, Gulfstream basically held 90%+ of the market for these ultra long range aircraft with their G650, which was by far their highest margin program. Bombardier has rolled out and has started production of their competing Global 7500, and so over the next few years, collectively they'll probably have about 80% of the market share. Dassault competes with them as well, although a bit smaller. But, we think that the new programs from General Dynamics will give their Gulfstream business a really good fighting chance in the market share battle against Bombardier.
This is Doug being like, and then I test drive them.
Yes.
And like see Kevin, how I feel.
Just like Kevin Tynan.
Kevin gets
a new car every couple of weeks.
Exactly. Okay. Doug gets his private jet.
All right, Doug. Thanks so much for joining us. Doug Rothick, our Bloomberg Intelligence Aerospace Analyst. That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.